God is with you.
Yes.
Let us pray. O God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. A fox one day spied a beautiful bunch of ripe grapes hanging from a vine, trained along the branches of a tree. The grapes looked so good. They looked like they were about to split open with all the juice inside of them, and the fox's mouth was watering just looking at them. But that particular bunch of grapes was very high up in the tree, and the fox had to jump for it. So the first time he jumped, he missed it by a mile. When I was in high school, I had single-digit vertical jump, and I can't imagine it's gotten better with age. So he walked off a short distance, right? Nope. Still missed it. So he does that several more times until he's worn out and he's out of breath and he sits down and he says, "You know what? I was wrong about those grapes anyway. They look pretty sour to me. I'm going home." So that, some of you may be familiar with, is a story from Aesop's Fables. And Aesop's Fables are basically the Twilight Zone for kids. In that, you have a story, then at the end there's a man that comes on screen and says, "This is what you're supposed to get from the story, dummy." Which isn't my favorite mode of storytelling. I like to figure it out for myself. But all of that aside, this was the story that came to mind first when I read the passages for this week. Both passages talk about grapes and vines, so there's that connection. But beyond that, the attitude of the fox in this story is not unlike the attitude of the community that produced the Gospel of John. Often when we look at this passage of John's, we commit two cardinal sins of biblical interpretation. The first is we look at it in isolation. We look at it out of context of what comes before it and after it, as well as out of its historical context. The second is we don't get the reference when a writer in the New Testament is quoting something from the Old Testament. Actually, I'll throw in a third sin just as a bonus. We want to put the most positive, familiar, feel-good spin on things as we can. That's another sin of biblical interpretation. All of which adds up to an interpretation of a passage like this that focuses solely on what John is saying about our connection to Jesus and doesn't at all address that whole business about some other vines being lopped off to make room for new vines. And look, there's nothing wrong with focusing on the positive. It's a great metaphor. We are connected to Jesus, and through Jesus, we're also connected to everybody else. Jesus is the source of life and health and wholeness that flows through us. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. We've all heard it before several times, maybe even hundreds of times if you were like me and spent a minimum of 2 days in a church building every week for your whole life, pretty much. What we don't do nearly as well, what we struggle to focus on and deal with faithfully, is that tendency we have to feel secure in ourselves and in our connection to God by virtue of our understanding of who isn't connected to God. It's that comparison game that people do with absolutely everything. I mean, I'm fat, but I'm not as big as that guy, so I guess I'm doing okay. I'm not a very good student, but I'm not at the bottom of the class, so. I'm pretty broke, but I'm not duct taping my shoes back together because I can't afford new ones broke. We define ourselves and derive our self-esteem from the ways we compare to others and come out on top all the time. What we have to deal with in this passage is that while, yes, the text is about how we are connected to God, the subtext is about how we are connected to God, unlike those Jews. Yeah, it feels yucky to say, right? That's what John is saying. It's no accident that much of the justification for atrocities committed against Jewish people by Christians is taken from John's gospel. You see, when we read this passage today, "I am the vine, you are the branches," we forget that the person person who originally wrote it wasn't just writing it to paint this nice picture of what a Christian community should be. John was a part of a group that had just gotten kicked out of the synagogues. The first couple of generations of Christians weren't called Christians at all. They were just Jews who happened to believe Jesus was the Messiah that they all believed in and were waiting for. And they peacefully coexisted and they worshiped with other Jews who happened to not believe that. And I know that that level of harmony through difference sounds insane to us today. We, after all, are part of a tradition that has split over literally anything and everything. Any small theological point you can imagine has caused a division in the church. People who believe in baptizing babies and people who believe exclusively in adult believer baptism can't go to church together. But you mean to tell me religious communities where half the people do believe in Jesus and half of them don't got along just fine? Yeah, they did. Because to them, staying as one community was more important than any one perspective winning out. And that would be true for decades until Rome messed it all up, as they like to do. In the year 70, Rome marched on Jerusalem and they destroyed the Jewish temple and they ramped up their persecution of the Jews in general, and this understandably caused some tension in the Jewish community. And they needed somebody to blame for what was happening, and they needed a sense of control over the situation, even though they were really powerless. That's why the scapegoating impulse is so strong in people. Not only do we want a reason, we want a thing we can point to blame for where our life is falling apart, but we also want to feel like we can do something about it. We want to feel like we can fix it. The word scapegoat, it comes from the ancient practice of a priest performing a ritual where it puts all of the community's sins onto a literal goat. And then they would release the goat into the wilderness to be eaten by wolves. And in so doing, the people thought they were getting rid of their sins along with the poor goat. The people believed this would absolve them, that it would appease whatever forces sought to do them harm. Jesus himself is a kind of scapegoat, an innocent party made to atone for somebody else's mistakes. So the Jews at the time of the fall of the temple needed a scapegoat. They needed somebody to blame, they needed something they could control, and they found that scapegoat in the Jews who did believe in Jesus. Now we all know that what happened wasn't their fault, it wasn't the Christians' fault, it was Rome's fault. It's always Rome's fault. Repeat after me, it's always Rome's fault. But scapegoats, by definition, need to be less powerful than we are, because we need to be able to control them, and there wasn't a thing they could do to stop a massive war machine like Rome. So they blamed the Christians instead. Synagogues started kicking out those Jews who believed in Jesus, blaming them for bringing trouble upon the community. And it's not, I want to be clear about this, it's not because the Jews who didn't believe in Jesus were bad people. There were just more of them. Had the tables been turned and the non-Jesus group been outnumbered, I'm sure the opposite would have happened, because the opposite has happened. The Reich Church in Germany kicked out anyone of Jewish descent in the 30s. Even today, incidents of hate crimes against Jewish people are common because some segments of society still blame them for the problems of the world, because they're a pretty small minority. And sadly, scapegoating those with less power than us is a really normal thing to do. So in the immediate aftermath of this devastating loss, in the wake of these Christians losing their community, losing the place where they worship, losing what felt like their family, in the wake of all that heartbreak and trauma, we have John talking about a vineyard getting some major landscaping work done. A vineyard where the old vines are being cleared out and burned in favor of planting some new ones. To really get what he's saying here, we have to understand that throughout the Hebrew Bible, the vineyard is the You can see that in the Isaiah passage that Ginny read this morning. So what John is saying is, look, I know you all used to think that the synagogue was the vineyard, that it was the interwoven, interconnected people of God, but they're not. You know who is? We are. We're the true vineyard, not them. John is basically calling the synagogue sour grapes. He's saying they're not sour grapes. Who wants to be a part of that sour vineyard anyway? Which is a very human thing to do. There's a reason Aesop used this as a theme for one of his fables. When we're kicked out or rejected, it's totally normal to convince ourselves that we didn't really want that thing anyway. They didn't hire me. Your boss is a jerk. I didn't get the part in the school play. Well, Grease is a stupid musical anyway. You don't want to go on a date with me? Well, that's fine, because you don't smell very good. Normal. And the Bible is full of normal people doing normal things. And I'm not saying that the vineyard isn't a beautiful image for the church. It is. In a vineyard, branches are almost completely indistinguishable from each other. There are no freestanding individual branches in a vineyard, but rather branches that surround each other, that hold each other. And at the very center, the vine that connects us all to each other and the root that nurtures and sustains us is Jesus. And God, the vine dresser who cares for us and protects us. And we all of us branches, have a job to do. But that job is just to abide, to stay together in love. But when we become a community more focused on and defined by who and what we aren't than by who and what we are, we're no longer abiding together in love, we're abiding together in mutual dislike. We stop being relevant, we go from living to just surviving, and Jesus said that he came to give life and life abundantly. Even more than that, when we build walls around ourselves to keep other people out, haven't we become the thing that hurt and rejected us in the first place? As if we have any right to the vineyard in the first place, as if we planted it, as if we're taking care of it. In the Isaiah passage, we see God putting all of this work into a vineyard. And vineyards ain't no picnic. They take a ton of work, because the natural tendency of grapes and people is to go sour when left to their own devices. So you constantly have to check on them, have to prune them. It takes years of preparation before a vineyard can actually produce anything you'd want to drink. And once they're ready, you have almost no time between when the grapes are ripe and when they are rotting on the vine. You have to work quickly to pick them. You have to hire a ton of workers to make sure you don't waste most of your crop. They take a lot of work. So God has put all of this work into the vineyard. He's done everything that God is supposed to do, and guess what? It still goes sour. So God condemns the vineyard to go wild, which is funny, because that's already what it's doing. God isn't harming the vineyard. God didn't put a curse on the vineyard. God is just letting the vineyard be what it insists on being anyway. You want to go to seed? Fine. I'm not going to get in your way. And I got to be honest, I don't always like this about God. I don't always like the freedom that God gives us. I don't like that we're allowed to hurt each other. I don't understand why God allows things like mass shootings or war or racism or homophobia or hatred or greed. I don't understand why God doesn't just stop us already. We are the kids throwing a tantrum in the grocery store, and I really like our mom to put us in timeout already. I don't know why. I don't know why we're allowed this much freedom, but like it or not, we are. We really are that free. We in ourselves, we in our communities, we are free to be what we want to be. We can be sour or sweet. We can be living or stagnant. We can be open or closed. And I think when we're at our best, the church is all of those good things and then some. I think when you are at your best, Hobart First, you can and have been all of those good things and then some. Through the various ministries here, through Mana Cafe and the drives and the fundraisers, the donation we made to buying a home for the Welcome Network, the way that we welcome people, whoever walks in through our doors. And then there's all the beautiful acts of love and faithfulness you all do in your individual lives, things I don't know about, things maybe nobody knows about. This church can, is, has been a wonderful vineyard. But the church is also a very human thing. So we need reminders from time to time. We need to be reminded to stay sweet and living and open. Because whatever we decide we'll be, we will certainly be. We are that free. May we remember that we are connected to God not because of who we prune or reject from our community, but because God has chosen to delight in every single one of God's creations. So let's let God worry about which branches belong here and which ones don't. God's a better gardener than we are anyway. Our job, our only job, is to abide together in love. I invite you to join in our responsive hymn. It's found on page